You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you in association with the Earth Station One Network. As always, I'm your host, Van Allen Plexico. This week, the topic is Marvel's cinematic universe, the world Marvel has created in its movies, separate and often different from the traditional Marvel Comics universe. Joining me to explore the cinematic universe is Jim Yelton. I've known Jim for several years now and have been a fan of his work ever since I first encountered it and him at Archon, the St. Louis sci-fi convention a few years ago. Who is Jim? Well, Jim has been creating in one way or another since his early teens, starting in theater as an actor, becoming a director while still in high school. He's been involved in over 30 stage productions. He's an experienced radio talk show host, which will serve him well today, and always found a way to sneak in his passion for movies and assorted geeky topics way before it was cool. But his real love has always been writing. I hear you, brother. And Jim has written for various media, including radio dramas, graphic novels, short stories, stage productions, and screenplays. A child of the 70s and 80s, much like me, he has channeled his love of the two stars, Star Trek and Star Wars, Marvel Comics, and horror movies into projects including the space adventure radio drama The Swindlers of Doom, which is a big favorite of mine, a superhero television pilot based on his illustrated novel Extraordinary. He is currently working on an action horror screenplay entitled Devil's Tower. Very opinionated and knowledgeable about a wide variety of pop culture, Jim has been a convention panelist with me a few times, covering everything from Battlestar Galactica to his love for all things Buffy and Joss Whedon-y, as well as workshops covering screenwriting and beating writer's block, something I've never really suffered from for some reason. We can talk about that maybe. He has recently begun teaching screenwriting courses in the Mid-Missouri area, and is turning his class lessons into an upcoming book, which sounds awesome, entitled Everything I Learned About Screenwriting Came from Spider-Man, Star Trek, and a Shark Named Bruce. Hey, Jim, welcome aboard White Rocket.
Oh, thank you very much, Van. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, I'm very, very happy to have you. You've been a friend for a while, and I love your work. Swindlers of Doom is one of my favorite sort of indie projects I've read in the last few years. I had a great time reading that. And it touched on a lot of things that I've always loved in sci-fi and sort of action-adventure pulpy stuff. And so I'm glad to see you doing more stuff and branching out and teaching the young people and all that. That's really cool.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you. I've been a big fan of your stuff for a while, and I'm glad there's new stuff coming out that I can read in the Sentinels universe too. So.
Oh yeah, and in fact, there'll be news about that. I appreciate that. There'll be news in the next probably on the next episode. We'll have the next Sentinels book out. I'm very excited about that, so I appreciate that. Tell me, before we get started, how did you end up teaching classes on screenwriting? That's something that since the last time I've talked to you, I think.
Yeah, well, it's something, there's a adult education program here in Columbia, Missouri, where I live, and it, you know from doing panels and workshops and things at conventions, you know, that was something that just interested me going mm-hmm. through the convention circuit. And this was kind of another outlet for me to be able to kind of take things that I've talked about at conventions and put them more into a formalized class setting. So the opportunity came up and I thought, well, I have a lot to say about writing, so I might as well get paid for it in some way, shape or form when I'm teaching people.
There you go. Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you got that going on. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I have to spend so many hours every week teaching my classes, which are not generally about things as fun as what you're doing. So I'm kind of envious in a way, but that's really cool. Well, we are here today to talk about a very fun subject. I think you and I both have always been Marvel fans. And when, you know, over the years, we got to start out by mentioning how it took Marvel so long to really get things going, because You know, it's kind of sad. I guess if you go back to the 70s, maybe we could go back earlier than that. But you and I both probably the 70s are where we really remember things firsthand.
Yeah.
And the 70s, you know, DC wasn't doing great, but at least they had the Super Friends and, you know, they had a few things cooking that were not horrible. And then Marvel every now and then would come out with something, and the fan community, which didn't really have a way to communicate back then as much because there was no internet or anything, but the fan community would try so hard to embrace it. And we would be like, oh, there's a Spider-Man TV show or a Captain America TV show. And we would watch it and we would just kind of go, oh boy, that was not good.
Yeah. And you know, what was interesting about those early attempts was, like you said, like DC kind of had more of a foothold, and I don't necessarily know that it was because DC's superhero universe had been around longer. I just think if you look at those early attempts that DC made, they were a little bit, you know, more tongue-in-cheek and campy. I mean, with the Batman TV series and with Wonder Woman, so hokiness of the live action setting for a superhero kind of played into the tone of the show. Whereas with Marvel stuff, I mean, whether it was, you know, Spider-Man or the two Captain America movies or the really horrible Doctor Strange movie or what was really good, which was the Incredible Hulk TV series, they took more of a straightforward take on the character, and they wanted it to be more dramatic and in line with what the comics were doing. And they didn't want it to be as jokey as the DC stuff. So I think that's why it didn't really work as well. Because in the 70s and early 80s, when the effects were really dragging behind what was able to be done on TV, it was just really hokey to see kind of Spider-Man climbing up a building when you could tell that it was a guy on a wire, you know.
You know, that's a good point. I think there's a couple that you make me think of a couple of things. One is, yeah, I think that for whatever reason, Marvel's characters required more special effects because Superman can fly and can punch. Batman can punch. Wonder Woman basically more or less punches, you know.
Right.
They're not hanging from a building, shooting webs out of their wrists, you know, flying in a suit of high-tech armor. You know, all the various things that the Avenger, Thor, my gosh, with all the effects that he has, you know.
Yeah.
And so really, I guess Captain America is the only one that seems like a DC character in terms of the powers are fairly limited and easier to replicate. And they did make a couple of sort of made for TV Captain America movies. But even then, that gets me to the second point that you kind of make me think of, which is that even then, they miss what made Marvel Comics so special. I think you're right that the DC universe, back then particularly, was always a little more hokey and a little more corny almost by design, because it was so much older, I think.
Right.
And so you could do the Super Friends, you could do a Superman TV show where he just, you know, pats little kids on the head and punches a gangster, and that was pretty much the character. Whereas the Marvel characters were so much more complex that if you didn't make any effort to sort of represent that complexity, then they really didn't seem authentic. And it's only been the modern stuff that has really tried hard to replicate and get across the complexity of the Marvel characters. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, and I think we're going to touch on this point later on when we talk about where they are now. But back then, if you think about it, they were still in that mode of licensing the characters to production companies and having them just kind of do whatever they wanted. So you in all of those early attempts in the 70s, you had basically TV people making creative choices that didn't make sense from a comic fan stance. And that's where we were disappointed, because, you know, I remember watching that Captain America TV movie, and he's not even in a facsimile of the Captain America costume that works for me until the very end of that first TV movie. And I kind of think to myself, well, you guys knew that you needed to have him in the actual Captain America outfit at some point. Why didn't you have him do that the whole movie? He was in this like really cheaply made costume for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And it just kind of takes you out of it. And, you know, like the shield is kind of clear and really flexible. And it's like, why can't you just it's not even about spending more money, because I don't think that that was the case. It was just you made a creative and production choice that kind of shortchanged the character a little bit. And
yeah.
So, you know, that's where I look at it and I say, it feels like back then there were people that were just making decisions because they thought it was going to be good TV, and they were really kind of shortchanging the success of the character.
Yeah, they just totally never understood what it was about Marvel in particular that was appealing. It's always these, you know, Hollywood types that think, oh, you know, these Marvel characters are popular. That must mean people want to see people in costumes beating up thugs or something. And they don't dive any deeper than that. That to anything beyond that to them was just extraneous. It was just, you know, not worth wasting their time on. And that was just agonizing for us as kids, right? To have to, you know, we're you and I are probably like 8 or 9 years old at one point and thinking, I could do a better job.
Right. Exactly. Well,
than these people.
And I do, you know, looking back on it, I do cut them a little slack because working in TV, you know, the budget was a little limited.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to have a huge superhero fight at the end of, you know, an episode of Spider-Man or The Incredible Hulk. Although the Hulk did do, you know, some pretty good throwdowns every once in a while. But, you know, you're not going to have the supervillains for those characters to play off of, you know, so the conflict was pretty run-of-the-mill, you know, 70s TV fodder for the time, because, you know, you just had gangsters and, you know, kind of shady bad guys for these superheroes to kind of fight. And I think that kind of limited our enjoyment of it, because, you know, we kept waiting and saying, well, okay, in Captain America's case, you're sitting back saying, well, where's Baron Zemo? Where's the Red Skull? Mm-hmm. You know, why isn't he at least fighting Nazis of some kind? You know, something, so that it's not just, you know, some general terrorist or bad guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's something that I've always been passionate about and frustrated about for my whole life, pretty much, is that it took forever for them to start, and by them I mean anybody, to start using real actual supervillains in any of the movies or TV shows. I mean,
yeah.
I remember the first legitimate supervillain. Now, I may have forgotten something or been missing something, but for my whole life, it seemed to me that the first legitimate supervillains we saw in a movie or TV show were the Negative Zone criminals in Superman 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Up until that, you never got anybody but just like nobody more powerful than Lex Luthor.
And I actually had a conversation with somebody not too long ago where we kind of waxed poetic about when Superman 2 came out, what a huge moment that was for us as fans, mm-hmm. because you're kind of sitting there saying, oh, wow, like Superman's actually going to get to fight people that are as powerful as he is.
Exactly.
I can't wait to see that fight.
Exactly.
And, you know, of course, what's one of the major high points of that movie is that fight in Metropolis between the Negative Zone criminals and Superman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that and I was just trying to think, when did Marvel finally
do that? You reminded me, because, you know, when I was thinking about the show today, mm-hmm. remember when Marvel did the Incredible Hulk TV movies?
Yeah.
Because the show had been off the air, what, 10 or 12 years at that point? And
seems
then they got
like it.
Yeah, they got Bill Bixby to come back. And that was kind of the first moment where I thought, oh, maybe Marvel's figured this out. Because the first one was The Incredible Hulk Returns, and that had Thor as a guest hero in it. And it seemed like they were saying, okay, we're going to try and do a unified universe on TV.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time reading that the plan was they were wanting to spin Thor off into his own show. And the network really didn't go for that. So then they did another TV movie. And that kind of brings it around to your question, because the next TV movie was The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, which had Daredevil.
Daredevil, yeah.
And the villain was Kingpin. And that's the first time I can remember Marvel in live action kind of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because even, you know, you can point back and say, well, the old Batman TV show had super villains. But honestly, Batman's villains are not super villains. They're villains who are weird kooks.
Right, right.
You know, so, and that's all fine and good, but there's a lot of difference between a guy putting on a Penguin tuxedo, you know, versus the Negative Zone criminals or versus like the Abomination or something. So, well, when do we actually, is it not until, well, first let me rephrase this. I'm sorry. The other problem I have with supervillains, okay, the other problem that I have with supervillains in these movies, both universes, is that when they finally did start using supervillains, they only would do like versus like. And what I mean is Superman versus the Negative Zone criminals. Right. And then Iron Man versus Ironmonger, right? Stain. Hulk versus Abomination. It's just over. A Spider-Man versus a Green Goblin. You never seem to get, you know, Thor versus Loki. I just keep thinking of more every time I say it. And I would just love to see a superhero fight a villain that's not just like him, with the same power set, basically.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I kind of wonder, that's what kind of interested me. I just recently was able to see the Spider-Man reboot. The Amazing Spider-Man, and
mm-hmm.
that kind of intrigued me that they used the Lizard as the villain in that, because it is a little, like you said, it's a little bit of a different power set from mm-hmm. Spider-Man.
That's true.
And it kind of takes Spider-Man in a different direction, where the fight scenes were different than what we were used to seeing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because even Doc Ock is basically, he's an octopus, but he's got eight legs. Well, guess what else has got eight legs? A spider, right?
Right.
So he wasn't, in technical terms, he wasn't that different from Spider-Man, more or less. So, yeah, I agree. The Lizard is really one of the few times that they've actually gone in a different direction. See, like the first Iron Man movie, it's a bigger iron bad guy. In the second Iron Man movie, there's War Machine, and there's Whiplash, who is basically Iron Man with slightly less armor, right? And then...
Yeah.
I'm concerned that in the third Iron Man movie, it's going to be, yeah, the Mandarin, but the Mandarin will be sicking an armored guy on him.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the problems I had with Iron Man 2 was they didn't really stick with Mickey Rourke being Whiplash for more than half of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, once he was captured, you know, after the Monaco Grand Prix sequence, he stopped being Whiplash.
Yeah.
And basically did what you're saying you have a problem with, which is he became another Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't just he's a bigger, badder Iron Man. He had a whole bunch of armored soldiers to kind of throw at Iron Man. So, you know, it was just bigger, badder, and more of them.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of worried about that with the next one as well.
Yeah, I was hoping that if we got Hammer, that instead of a bunch of guys in armor, because basically they took part of the plot of Midas, where Midas had taken over Stark International before Stain ever existed in the comics. Midas had taken over Stark International, got a hold of all the extra suits of armor, put robots inside them, and Midas was sicking all these robotic Iron Men on the real Iron Man. So,
right.
So part of Iron Man 2 was the Midas storyline that Bill Mantlo wrote back in the late 70s. But then he kind of rolls the roadie thing in there, and he has Hammer. Well, if he had Hammer, I was hoping for, like, instead of 20 different Iron Men, I was hoping for 20 different minor villains that Iron Man could just beat the crap out of. Because that's one of the great moments. I don't know if you've ever read that comic. Bobby Polite and I were talking about it a few weeks ago, that one of the great moments in Iron Man's Michelini-Layton history was when Hammer had the whole army of cheap supervillains and he sicked them on Iron Man, and Iron Man just wades through this whole army of supervillains and just beats them all down in like 5 minutes. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and from a movie standpoint, if you want to kind of appease the fan base a little bit,
mm-hmm.
having that kind of a setup to where you could throw in, you know, 10 different Iron Man villains,
yeah,
and have a massive fight scene with all these guys, you don't have to do a setup backstory to all of them.
No.
The setup backstory is, you know, Hammer's gone and found these thugs and he's given them all these weapons to go kill Iron Man. That's
right.
The setup.
That's all. Yeah, it takes 2 seconds, right? Yeah, so, I mean, I did like, since we're talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I did like Rockwell playing Hammer. I mean, I like
yes.
him in almost everything he does, and I thought that was an interesting take. I mean, I guess what's his name? Peter Cushing was no longer with us, so he couldn't get Cushing to do it. That's who he was supposed to be. But I thought that was an interesting choice. Okay, well, let's see. Moving along to the main feature here, they finally started getting Marvel characters right, probably, would you say, with Blade and then the first X-Men movie?
Yeah, well, you know, if you think about Blade, it kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I think it was at a point where Marvel was just like, well, you know, he's kind of like this third or fourth tier character. Mm-hmm. It would make an okay horror movie. Somebody wants to do it. We'll license it out. Yeah. And surprisingly enough, they had somebody like actually do Blade. Yeah. And I think that freaked everybody out because they were like, wait a minute. If we actually do the character from the comic, it'll be a good movie. Like, how's that supposed to work?
It was a shock. Right? What a surprise. Yeah. And then they did the first X-Men movie, which I think that Brian Singer, let me ask you, give me two or three things at most that Brian Singer got right that made that first X-Men movie work like a Marvel movie and not like, you know, the Fantastic Four by Roger Corman or something.
Right. Well, you know, the one thing still to this day, I'm constantly re-ranking movies, and I know you do this too because we've talked about it.
Yeah.
On my list of, you know, the top five best superhero movies of all time, X-Men 2 is on that list because it feels like you're watching a comic book.
Yeah.
And I think he started to do that in the first one. I think there was too much setup that he had to do, but he clearly, and the writers and producers clearly got that X-Men universe.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew how to set up Professor X versus Magneto,
mm-hmm.
and what that conflict was, and kind of how to do a shorthand version of it in a 2-hour movie. Because mm-hmm. that's the tough part about doing a comic book movie, is that in a lot of these cases, you've got, you know, so much history that it's really hard to kind of condense that down and hit the high points for people who are not fans of the property. Mm. And I think they did that really well with the first one, because did they tell the entire story of the X-Men in 2 hours? No, but they gave you enough of a taste so that you knew who the characters were and kind of what the conflict was.
I think you make a really good point that, I would say this before the X-Men. I'll reference what I think that you said was dead on. As I draw this out here, I think that before the first X-Men movie, the movie producers, directors would have felt compelled to start at the very beginning and explain how Charles did. You know, you would have gotten X-Men Origins almost. You'd have gotten the whole setup. What Singer did was kind of jump into the story already in motion. And what you said is right, is that he focused on that conflict between Professor X and Magneto. And so everything that already existed, he could just say was already in place. Don't ask questions. You know, don't worry about why there happens to be this school for mutants. Don't ask how Charles came to run it. Don't ask how Charles is paralyzed, you know, he can't walk. Don't ask any of that. Just go with it, right?
Right.
Just pick it up and focus on the human story of the two kings and their chess pieces.
Right. And I think the great thing that they did was this was a team movie that had a lot of moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exactly right. They chose the important stuff to focus on and said, you know, you don't really need a ton of setup to get that Scott Summers and Jean Grey have a relationship.
Right.
You know, we can kind of do some shorthand throughout the movie to show that, and also kind of bring Wolverine into it so that we're setting up this love triangle mm-hmm. between the three of them. We don't have to focus on that in one movie. If we do our job and make this a great movie, we'll have three or four other movies that we can focus on that. And I think that was the thing, was they were smart enough to realize that they had a franchise in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had plenty of time to tell the story. Let's focus on this one story and get this right. And the story that needs to be focused on is Professor X and Magneto.
Yeah, and I think that by making the characters so clear, you don't have to do as much background and setup. When characters, I think, are kind of weak, you have to explain them. But when the characters are very vivid and strong, you don't really have to explain them beforehand. You just set them in motion, and they explain themselves as you watch them operate. And that's kind of what they did, I think, all the way through all the X-Men movies. And I even like the third one, call me crazy, but I like that one just fine.
Man, you're crazy.
But see, I'm not a big X-Men fan, so I wasn't personally involved. I just was like, oh, that happened? Cool, okay.
Right, okay. Well, then I'll cut you a little bit of slack then, because...
Oh, you know, they fought villains. Awesome. I'm good with that. Hey, in 1978, we'd have thought X-Men 3 was the greatest superhero movie of all time. Am I wrong?
Well, no, I want to... Had I seen the first two X-Men, then yeah, I maybe would have had some problems with it.
Right.
But, you know, the thing that always amazes me, and I kind of wanted to start this off with this quote, but, you know, we've gotten into the discussion a little bit. You know, just the idea that we live in a world where I've seen an X-Men movie and an Avengers movie just blows my mind.
Yes.
I mean, in the middle 80s, when I really got hardcore into the X-Men, when Claremont was writing it and it was on its, you know, uphill climb to just being the biggest thing ever, I knew that it was going to make that movie. I never in my wildest dreams thought that we were going to have an Avengers movie. And that we have both of them just freaks me out to no end when I think about it. So, yeah, I probably, you know, 8-year-old me would probably think the third X-Men was the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
But 8-year-old me also hadn't read all the really good Claremont stories. Right. So.
Right. Right. Well, okay. So the X-Men movie is all well and good and it gets things going. And the bar I think is sort of raised at that point. And, cause you know, the 80s Batman movies are already in the rearview mirror. The run of Superman movies are way in the rearview mirror. DC is sort of floundering around as the 2000s begin. They of course did have their great success with the three Batman movies, but that aside, DC really just sort of had all their success in animation, I think, in terms of moving characters instead of, you know, on the page. And so Marvel suddenly, with this little bit of momentum, I mean, because Marvel didn't make the X-Men movie. People may not realize, you know, that was a Fox.
Yeah.
Fox did that. Marvel decides, let's get a big loan of cash now that we're not bankrupt anymore, right? Let's get a great big loan and start producing our own movies and do them more like the X-Men movie and less like everything Marvel had ever done before. And the result for the – well, they did the – there was the Ang Lee movie, but that was a sort of a misstep, I think. And did the second Hulk movie come out before or after Iron Man? I should know this.
It's actually the Ang Lee movie was not them. That was the last licensed movie that they did.
Right.
And somehow they got the rights to the Incredible Hulk back.
Okay.
So that they could do the reboot with Ed Norton.
Right.
And that actually came out after Iron Man.
Okay. That's what I thought. All right. So Iron Man is the one. They get this big loan of money from like Chase Manhattan or somebody.
Yeah.
For like $500 million or something. And they make Iron Man. And that really was the moment. Now, it's kind of funny for me to talk about Iron Man because there's two separate things here. There's me looking at it objectively, which is, okay, Iron Man was the movie that Marvel made that said, bang, Marvel is now a real player at making good quality movies with their characters. Okay, there's also the subjective me, which is, oh my gosh, they've made a movie of my all-time favorite character, and it kicked ass.
Right.
I mean, so I was struggling because part of me was wanting to look at the big picture and go, okay, Iron Man means we're going to get Thor, Captain America, Avengers, whatever. But there's another part of me that's like, I just want Iron Man movies forever and better ones. Cause I wasn't, you know, it's kind of hard to describe. I mean, I guess I'm kind of an Iron Man perfectionist, right? But I've been reading Iron Man since 1977 and I loved a lot of that movie, and I was disappointed by some of it. Now, you know, like we were saying about X-Men 3, if you look at it in the context of they made an Iron Man movie, then yes, 10 out of 10, I'm ecstatic, I'm orgasmic, hooray. But if you look at it in the terms of you're a huge Iron Man fan for the last 40 years, what do you think about this story? Well, then I'm like, well, you know, it was okay. Because it was, you know, what really kicked butt about that movie was obviously Downey as Tony Stark.
Yeah.
But the villain was kind of, and the battle with the villain was very short. He really didn't do a whole lot as Iron Man in that movie. If you just went and cut just the Iron Man fight scenes out of that movie, the whole thing is probably about 10 minutes, if that. You know, so a lot of it was just Tony Stark's personality. And by the way, as an Iron Man fan, that's another problem I had with it, which is that Robert Downey does not have or portray Tony Stark's personality. This is a completely different character. Now, this gets us into that Marvel Cinematic Universe being different from the Marvel Comics universe. The Robert Downey Jr. Tony Stark is nothing like the Marvel Comics Tony Stark. Until after he became such a big success, Marvel has started making their version more like the movie version. I think because Marvel says, we've had Tony Stark for 40 years. He's never been that exciting. Let's make him more like Robert Downey Jr. That's exciting, right? But it just was disappointing to me because basically I'm watching a movie where Iron Man becomes a big success and becomes popular basically by acting like Hawkeye and not like Iron Man. And my corollary on that is when they then bring Hawkeye in the Avengers movie, he's utterly boring because they've already given his personality to Iron Man. Okay, go right. with that.
Well, and I was going to bring up, I mean, for people that have read your novels, your Sentinel novels, I heard one of your podcasts not mm-hmm. too long ago where you brought up the point that, you know, they basically did what you've been doing for years, which is they took Tony Stark and gave him Hawkeye's personality.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's Ezra Brakus and mm-hmm. and the Sentinels books. But I think what's interesting about what Marvel's been doing with the movies that they have control of is I think they realize that movies are different than comics.
Yeah.
And as a comics fan, it is kind of hard to kind of detach yourself from that and say, you know, it is a different form of storytelling. And these characters aren't necessarily going to be the same character that I grew up loving because they have to take that character and kind of shoehorn them into a 2-hour movie versus a monthly comic that comes out 12 times a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, because one of the things that I'm having big problems with is that it seems like they're taking storylines that you and I grew up reading over a several year period of time and taking all of them and lumping them into 1, 2, or 3 movies. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're getting the entire history of Iron Man's great stories mm-hmm. in, you know, this trilogy of movies.
In like 6 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. And instead of, you know, taking their time and kind of like giving them to us a little bit at a time. And it took me a while to kind of wrap my head around that, but I thought, well, you know, they've really only got a finite amount of time to tell these stories with these actors. So, yeah, why wouldn't you want to tell the best stories and not just kind of wait, okay, we're going to do this story in Iron Man 6. I mean, there might not be an Iron Man 6. We've mm-hmm. got to do it now. You know, and that's why I was kind of surprised when they did the whole thing with Stane in the first one and then – they kind of shot their load with Justin Hammer in the second one to where I don't know that he makes a credible villain to bring back at any point.
Right.
And, you know, that Justin Hammer is not the Justin Hammer of the comics.
Not at all.
But he works really well within the context of that Iron Man 2 story.
And he works really well with Robert Downey. You know, you basically change. But let's put it this way. In the comics, Tony Stark is a very classic heroic guy.
Right.
He's not a comedian. He's not wacky. He's just a smart, heroic guy. And Justin Hammer is the classic sort of British Bond villain played by Peter Cushing.
Right.
And that's a nice sort of head-to-head matchup in the comics. Well, in the movies, if your hero has gone from classical leading man hero to wacky Robert Downey Jr., then I think it was probably not a bad idea, if you're going to change Hammer, to make him into wacky bad guy industrialist who wants to be Tony Stark and keeps failing miserably, and he's kind of funny at it. So what they did with him, I liked, right? I mean, I don't know I wanted him changed, but it worked.
But you liked it.
Yeah.
And I think that was a function of just the way movies are made, because you can have the greatest script in the world, and it could take an entire 180-degree turn once you cast somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what happened with Iron Man was – and, I mean, I think you and I both agree, Robert Downey Jr. was the best thing that could have happened to Marvel when they cast him. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody realized it at the time, except for maybe a couple of people. But that changed fundamentally how Tony Stark was going to be portrayed in these movies.
And in the comics.
Yeah, and that's the other point I was going to make, is that it's coming full circle, because now you have Marvel's publishing arm taking notice of the movies and saying, well, we've got all of this awareness because of the movies now. Mm-hmm. We need to make our comics more in line with the movies, not vice versa.
Yeah, I think part of it is you want to make the comics more like the movies, so that when people that have seen the movies, and there are a lot more people that have seen and enjoyed the Iron Man movies than have ever read the comic, sad to say, when they come looking for the comics, they're going to be like, I want Tony to act like that. And I understand that. But I think at the same time, Marvel kind of said, we've had this Tony Stark character for 40 years or 50 now, right? And he's never been all that big in Marvel history. He's always been kind of B-list at best. Well, now we suddenly have a blueprint for how to do Tony Stark that gets people excited, makes them laugh, makes them interested. Let's just go with that and pretend the other Tony Stark never existed. And that's pretty much what they did. Yeah.
But I think that all comes back to Marvel, when they got their line of credit and decided they were going to start making movies, they may not have had this grand unified plan for having what, you know, is now being called the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but they had an inkling that that's something they could do if the first Iron Man was successful. If they didn't have that inkling, we never would have had the post-credits sequence with Nick Fury showing up at Tony Stark's house.
Yeah.
And the great thing about that was, you know, we all got excited by it, but that's because we're comic fans. If that movie had tanked, it wouldn't have really mattered that much. It would have just been like something cool. But the fact that it was such a big hit, they had that sequence at the end of the credits, and now all of a sudden, it's like the whole world opened up. And they could do everything from that point on.
Everything they have the rights to do, which becomes sort of problematic, I guess. But we'll get to that in a second, I guess. Before we continue dissecting the movies, and I do want to do that, and we'll kind of finish up sort of with that to a degree, let's look at the changes recently. I want to diverge onto that for just a second. As I've said before, the 800-pound mouse in the room, Disney, came along, and Disney has bought not just Star Wars, as everybody knows, but also basically Marvel.
They just want to own all entertainment that's produced worldwide forever.
Everything, right.
I'm waiting until I get my phone call, because I know it's going to come at some point. They're just going to say, hey, you wrote something. We want to own it.
We may not ever do anything with it, but we just want to be able to say, yeah, we own that. Well, what do you think? Short-term, long-term, good, bad with Disney?
You know, it was really weird because I had the same emotions – you know, several years ago when Disney bought Marvel that I did more recently when the news came out that they bought Lucasfilm. And it's kind of, you know, mixed, because for so many years and being a Marvel Comics guy, I mean, I like DC, but I've always been a Marvel guy.
Right.
And struggling with them through all of these, you know, various stops and starts of them doing live action adaptations, I finally felt like they finally figured it out. And they were going to start making really great movies with the characters that they owned leading up to the Avengers, which was going to just blow my mind. And then when Disney bought them, I thought, well, this kind of sucks because the guys that I was really excited about making these movies might not make the movies anymore. Mm-hmm. But the thing I keep reminding everybody is Disney didn't become Disney by making bad choices. I mean, every once in a while they'll stumble, but they're really smart and they let people that know what they're doing do what they do. I mean, it's the reason why when they made the deal with Pixar, part of that deal was that John Lasseter, who is, you know, the grand poobah at Pixar, was going to take over Disney's animation too. So he was going to control all of Disney animation because that's what he does. And I knew that Disney was going to let the Marvel guys make the Marvel movies the way they needed to be. So, you know, there was a little bit of hesitation because I felt bad that Marvel wasn't going to be able to do it on their own. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing to think that the biggest entertainment conglomerate on the world is funding the rest of these movies. So, you know, at least we know we're going to get them. Because if anybody knows how to maximize licensing and merchandising, it's Disney.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I think it's a net positive, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And especially with, you know, and I know we're going to talk later on about, you know, some of the future stuff coming up, mm-hmm. you know, they're not pulling back.
Right.
You know, from since the Disney sale, some of their ideas that they've talked about putting into the cinematic universe, they've not pulled back on that. In fact, they're going more forward with that. So I do think it's a net positive.
Yeah. How about how the Marvel Cinematic Universe has evolved to where it is now? And how it's different from the regular Marvel Universe. Has that been an overall net positive or negative in your view there?
I, you know, to be honest, the fan part of me says that it's kind of a push because I feel like it's really cool to see this stuff in a big screen movie. And it's just kind of a trade-off because, you know, of the shorthand storytelling you have to tell in a movie, mm-hmm. you know, we do kind of lose some of the richness of the universe, I think.
Yeah.
And that's where, as a fan, it is kind of disappointing for me when I see some of these movies because I see story arcs with characters or, you know, little things that they throw in. And I'm like, man, you know, they really, like, play that out over a couple of years in the comic. And they only did it for 5 minutes in the movie.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the stuff that I miss because I feel like there was a richness to the storytelling in the comics that we're just not going to get because the movies are about, you know, a predetermined plot that has to be wrapped up in 2 hours.
You know, that to bring in another example real quickly, that's one of the things about Iron Man 2, you know, that we've already talked about a little bit that I didn't like. Was that movie, it's exactly what you just now said. It's like they took several big things from the comics history and tried to do each one of them in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if we learned anything from Spider-Man 3, it's don't try to do too many things and give each one short shrift because then the overall, the whole suffers when the individual parts are not done comprehensively enough, I think.
Well, and I do hope that they learned a lesson from Iron Man 2. Because Iron Man 2 seemed like nothing more than we have to get the character from here to point B
mm-hmm.
for the Avengers. And we need to set up all this other stuff that's going on with S.H.I.E.L.D. and Black Widow and Nick Fury. And, you know, the rest of the plot was just kind of secondary. And, I mean, they almost could have put any villain into that movie and it would have been the same movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of bothered me a little bit because I kind of feel like one of the things that Marvel does really well is its villains. And if you're not going to treat the villains as respectfully as you do your heroes, then you're kind of suffering.
And that was part one of our two-part conversation about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Jim and I had a lot to say about this topic, so I've broken it into two episodes, and you can hear the second part next week right here on the White Rocket Podcast. I think it's pretty good stuff. We continue looking at the present and the future of Marvel's movies, and we even talk a little bit about DC and what they wanted to do and what they may yet do. Meanwhile, in part because some have pointed out that I don't talk enough on here about what White Rocket actually does when it's not sponsoring a podcast, I thought I'd take this opportunity to quickly tell you about some of the new books that have recently come out from the publishing wing of White Rocket. Last week, Jeff Dicer visited the show and talked about his new pulp best-selling novel, The Golden Age. It's pretty exciting to see White Rocket launching a whole new superhero novel franchise to go along with the Sentinel series, and we appreciate Jeff bringing that property to White Rocket. It's a fun read with the Golden Age characters in all their glory during World War II. Now, speaking of the Sentinels, in the last couple of months, we've seen the publication of a paperback omnibus of The Grand Design and one of The Rivals, the two big story arcs that comprise the first six novels in the Sentinel series. Each of these omnibus collections includes three full-length novels plus all 15 of Chris Kohler's awesome full-page illustrations, for a total of 30 of Chris's illustrations in all in the two books. The Grand Design book is over 600 pages of action and adventure with the origins of the team and their first clashes with their main adversary, the Warlord, among others. And The Rivals is more than 700 pages and is the more cosmic storyline with vast and powerful Galactus-level beings, or Celestials-level beings, coming to Earth and our heroes having to find some way to defeat them or at least drive them away. The newest novel in the Sentinel series, Metal God, should be on sale in a matter of days from this recording, and begins a whole new storyline in the wake of the World Mind Stellar Axe crisis, as Pulsar has to form a new team of Sentinels, while Ezro and Mondrian cross the galaxy to try to avert an interstellar civil war. Chris Kohler did the cover of this one, too, with Sarah White doing the colors, and I think it looks spectacular. I can't wait to get that book out to the public and hear some reaction of what you think about it, because I'm very excited. And finally, I'd like to mention the Blackthorn Saga from White Rocket Books. It began with an anthology of short stories, Blackthorn, Thunder on Mars, by new pulp favorite writers like Ian Watson, Bobby Nash, Sean Taylor, James Palmer, and our own Mark Buskett, plus my double-length origin story to kick it off. That book, which was intended to be a sort of post-apocalyptic homage to both John Carter of Mars and Thundar the Barbarian, gets the ball rolling. Then comes Ian Watson's epic novel, Blackthorn Dynasty of Mars, which intertwines what's happening with Blackthorn's trio in the present of the story with a fascinating and exciting look at the history of this strange Mars with its mad sorcerers and its super science and barbarians and all kinds of crazy stuff. It's great stuff all around, and I hope you'll check it out. You can find any of these at whiterocketbooks.com or on amazon.com, or ask your bookstore to order any of these White Rocket publications. Okay, that's the show for this week. I hope you'll join us again next time as we jump into more of the conversation with special guest Jim Yelton. Until then, take care, and we'll see you down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.